nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Enjoy the show.
So just to remind you what we were doing last week, I said this course is generally about trying to understand current flow in small devices, and a good generic device to think of is something like this, where you have an active region called the channel across which you have two contacts, call those the source and the drain. And if you put a voltage across it, current flows, and resistance is, of course, voltage divided by current. Now, what makes a transistor is that is the ability to change that resistance. So in a transistor, you have this third terminal called the gate. And by putting a voltage on that, and ideally no current flows here, but what that voltage does is it actually changes the resistance. And a typical transistor, in its off state and on state, the resistance will have changed by like five orders of magnitude. So like from 10 kilo ohms to say 100 mega ohms. And that's what you call a switch, in the sense you're switching from this low resistance to a high resistance state. And they said a lot of the wonderful things that a computer does is because you have almost a billion of these transistors working in concert. Now, so this then is like a generic device that we can think about. And as I said, in this course, we won't go into the details of any particular device. It's more has to do with just how to think about current flow on atomic scale. You know, where, as I say, today's commercial devices, the length of the channel is down to hundreds of atoms. So how do you think about current flow when you're on an atomic scale? So that's really what this course is about, as we have discussed. Now, the basic approach that we have discussed last week, and what I'll try to do is kind of complete that discussion today, is that in general, when you are trying to understand current flows through something like this, the basic quantities you need to know are these: the density of states, which tells you, like, in a given energy range, how many states you have. So the units of this are so many states per electron volt. See? That's one thing you need to know. And two other things you need to know is how easily electrons come in or go out into the two contacts. And that is described by a quantity which has the dimensions of per second. So it's like, if I put an electron in here, does it take a picosecond to get out? In which case, gamma over h bar would be inverse of a picosecond, which would be like 10 to the 12th per second, right? Because a picosecond is 10 to the minus 12 seconds. So when you take its inverse, that's like 10 to the power plus 12 per second. So if an electron takes a picosecond to get out, then that quantity would be 10 to the 12th per second. Now, this is defined as gamma divided by h bar. The whole thing is per second. What that means is the units of gamma itself is energy, because it's like h bar times energy. And roughly, I think 10 to the 12th per second would amount to about a milli electron volt of energy. So those are the two, three basic things you'd need to know if you're trying to describe the current flow through any conductor. That is, what is the density of states? How easily do electrons get in and out? That's it. So the basic equations that we discussed last week, and this week today what I'll try to do is derive those equations a little more carefully and a little more generally. What I mean by that is, when I was discussing it last week, I said, let's assume those two things are equal, the same gamma for both. In general, those two don't have to be equal. One contact could be stronger than the other. So I put a gamma 1 and a gamma 2. So we'll try to derive the equations more in the general case today. Now, the basic equations look something like this. I is equal to, if we look at the number of states in a given energy range, move over a little more, you have, so this is the density of states per unit energy, and if you consider an energy range dE, small energy range, then the total number of states is that much, and the current through this will be like Q, I mean, this tells you sort of the, when you multiply with gamma over H bar, that tells you the rate at which electrons flow, and then if you multiply by Q, it becomes current, because each electron carries that much charge. And last week when I wrote it as gamma over 2 H bar, saying that, well, it takes gamma over H bar to get in, I mean, and then another gamma over H bar here, and if it takes a picosecond to get in and a picosecond to get out, it takes about 2 picosecond all the way, hence divided by 2. Now, the correct expression in general would be something like this. Gamma 1, gamma 2 divided by gamma 1 plus gamma 2. And that H bar I had here, I'll just put it here, kind of out of the way. That's all. And this you can check. If you put those two things equal, then you see it becomes, you know, if both are equal to gamma, then it becomes like gamma squared divided by 2 gamma, which comes to half gamma, like I wrote last week. See? But the more general thing is this one. That's what I'll try to do now, show you why it's there. And there was one more factor that needs to go in, and this is, of course, the most important physical insight that we kind of started this course with on Monday itself, I tried to get across, is that what really drives current is the fact that you have two different Fermi functions in the two contacts. The idea that here you have a contact with a certain chemical potential, mu 1, and here you have a different chemical potential, mu 2. And if you draw the corresponding Fermi functions, it would look something like this is F1. And if I draw the corresponding one here, it would look something like this. So the two contacts are in equilibrium. And the occupation of levels is described by this Fermi function, which is almost 1 below mu, 0 above mu. And the only reason current flows is because when you consider the states in here, there's one contact which wants to fill it up, one contact which wants to empty it. And that's why current keeps flowing, and anything outside that window is irrelevant. So the point is that this has to be multiplied by this F1 minus F2. Actually, those are also functions of energy. So just to be clear, let me write it out. So this is the expression then for the current through the energy levels in a given range dE. And if you want the total current, you integrate it. So the expression would look something like this. Now, if you're actually evaluating this on a computer, of course, you set up a energy grid, find the current through this range, and then through this range, and through this range, and add them all up. And that's basically constitutes doing the integral. Right? That's what the first homework was about. Okay. Now, the next important point that we went through towards the end of last week was the idea that when you put a voltage on something, one thing you do, of course, is pull the mu, the chemical potential down, but you also have to worry about what it does to the density of states itself in this region, because in this region, we are assuming this is a small device, but so that we can describe it by a single potential U somewhere in here. Of course, in practice, U will be something a little different on the left and on the right, but for this discussion we're assuming, you can just assume some average number. And what happens is, this density of states then floats up or down by U. So that's the equation. Now, question is how to find the U, and that's where the idea which we discussed last day is that U has two parts to it. One part which is determined just by the potentials on the electrodes. Namely, you could say I got 0 volts here, 1 volt there, 2 volts there. So what is it inside? And you have to solve the electrostatic problem to find that. That's this U sub L, solution of the Laplace equation. And to that you have to add another term which reflects the change in the number of electrons inside. So what that means is, supposing at equilibrium you had a certain number of electrons here, but once you apply a voltage, if the number of electrons changes, that itself tends to change the potential around. So if the number of electrons is greater than the equilibrium number, then you got more electrons, so more potential energy, it's harder for the next electron to come in. On the other hand, if number of electrons is less than the equilibrium number, it's easier for the next one to come in. So it would then be negative here. So to complete the story, what we need is another equation that will tell you how to find the number of electrons. See? Then you have the full thing. And that equation, and I'm kind of putting it down here and then we'll discuss this, goes something like, it's integral dE, number of electrons per unit energy. So just as you have a density of states per unit energy, you have sort of like a number of electrons per unit energy in a given region. And the way you find that is, you have to put integral dE. So this will be density of states times the occupation of those states. And the occupation of those states, the point is, here the occupation is given by F1, here the occupation is given by F2, inside it is something in between, as you might expect. Physically you expect that, you see, if you think of states in this energy, this one wants to fill it up, this one wants to empty it. So this would like the F here to be 1, this would like the F here to be 0, so it will end up being somewhere between 0 and 1. And that average is what is gamma 1 F1 plus gamma 2 F2 divided by gamma 1 plus gamma 2. This isn't obvious. I'm kind of stating the equations here. And what I'll do next is, I'll try to justify these. I'll try to explain where this comes from and where this comes from, how you could get that. That's what I'll try to do. Okay? So the electron density per unit energy is given by the density of states times the occupation. And the occupation is like a weighted average of what contact 1 wants and what contact 2 wants. That's it. Now, how would you solve this set of equations? Because what I'll be doing for the rest of the class is just trying to get these equations, trying to obtain this and this, where they come from. That's all I'll be trying to do. But if you, once you have the equations, how would you apply it? Well, what you did for your first homework, that was, there you needed only this equation. You were given a density of states, you didn't have to worry about the U, this is it, evaluate it straight. Now, you can't quite evaluate it because you need to find U, you see? And if you want U, you kind of need to evaluate that. But then you can't do this because you don't know N to start with. But then N is given by this equation, but then N itself again depends on U, you see? So what happens is, now if you actually want to evaluate these two equations have to be solved, what's called self-consistently. Simultaneously or self-consistently, I think is the word people use. So what you have to do then is, you start with some guess for U. So you say, okay, let's ignore this. Let's say N is equal to N0. So U is just equal to U sub L, whatever that is, given this problem. So let's just assume that. Evaluate N from here. Because once I assume some U, I can do this. So you find N. Then you go back here and say, well, you know, n isn't quite equal to n0. It's a little different. So I need to update my guess on u. So I first started with some guess. Let's call that, say I started with a guess of 0.1. Then I find n, and I put it back in here, and I find that this term is actually about 0.1. So I say, OK, let me now use a new guess, which is like what I'd started with, plus whatever it needs to be, another 0.1. So put 0.2. And then I put it back in again, and again evaluate it. So you keep doing this till, once you go through this, the u doesn't change much anymore. And usually, for small values of u0, it converges. I mean, often, you know, you're not guaranteed it will converge necessarily. It might go off. But usually, for small values of u0, it would converge. And if you have difficulty converging, then what people do is they say, well, let's say I started with 0.1, and when I calculate it back again, I get 0.1. Then instead of using a new guess of 0.2, I'll use something like, say, 0.15. I won't go all the way to 0.2. Because otherwise, what often happens, sometimes happens with big values of u0 is you kind of overshoot, keep overshooting both ways. You see, and you never quite converge. Okay. Anyway, so, but for often you don't really have to worry about it. You just take, we just iterate on straightforwardly, it would converge to a value. And when do you say that it has converged? Well, when the new value is almost the same as the old value. Now, almost is, of course, a subjective thing. Question is, when should you quit? And I'd say that usually KT is a good measure of, you know, what we consider convergence, in the sense that KT at room temperature is 25 millivolts. So I'd say if U is not changing by, say, a fraction of a millivolt, that's small enough. Okay. Anyway, so that's what would be involved then in solving this set of equations. Now, in a way, you see, if you have taken 305, I believe the last day when I asked you, like half the class had taken 305. And 305 also requires something like this. If we are actually solving it numerically, what you'd have then is, this is like Poisson's equation, basically. This is like a simplified version of Poisson's equation. That is, if you have taken 305, you have possibly seen something that would have looked something like this. That would be Poisson's equation, which says that the Laplacian of the potential depends on the electron density. So this, I would say, is like a simplified version of that, okay, for this discussion. And this one, which tells you what is the electron density for a given mu1 and mu2, that's this Fermi function, I'd say this would be the 305 version of this would have been the drift diffusion equation. So if you're doing 305, you try to do drift diffusion and Poisson self-consistently. That's what you would have been doing. Here it's like, we're much simpler, really, what we're talking about here. This and this have to be done self-consistently. But this thing about having to do a self-consistent calculation, that's really very important, because electrons are interacting particles. And most of the time, you see, we think of electrons as if they are non-interacting things. But this is an approximate way of taking into account the fact that electrons are interacting, so that if the average number of electrons goes down, it makes it a little easier for the other electrons to come in. Or if the average number goes up, it makes harder for the next one to come in. That part of it, that part of the story kind of is included in here. It's an approximate way of including it. And one of the things a little later this month I'll be talking about is we'll take examples of devices where that approximate way doesn't quite work. You see, where there are clear experiments showing that if you do it this way, you don't quite get the right answers. But that's a very small subset of experiments. And so most of the time, though, we assume this kind of a model. This is what is widely used. And this generally works. It's just that there is a class of devices, which are very important devices, usually memory devices, where, this doesn't quite work. And that we'll get to like the end of this month. In a couple of weeks. Okay. Anyway, so what I want to do next is then try to explain where this comes from and where this comes from. Now, the basic idea would be that let us try to write the current. Let me draw this again here. I'll just draw the density of states here. So we have some density of states in the middle, which I've drawn here. This axis is the energy. This is the density of states. As I said, as I've said before, one of the things you have to get used to is usually you draw the independent variable horizontally. So normally you might have wanted to draw it this way. See? Whereas because energy levels are drawn like this, it's kind of easier if you have to if you turn it around. It's just that it gets takes a little time to get used to seeing this graph this way. Okay. And the same with the Fermi function that we have gone through before. Okay. So we have this density of states, and what we are trying to write down is this current. Now, question is, how would we obtain this equation for the current and this equation for the electron density? And the approach is something like this. Let's try to write, say, the current at this interface between the contact and the channel, or at this interface between the channel and the and this other contact. So one of these we're trying to write. Okay. Now, if you have a certain density of electrons here. So, you know, the density of electrons in this region, you could write as, say, the number of states you have in a given energy range times the occupation of those states, let's say. So F tells you whether the states are occupied or not. And offhand, of course, I do not know what the occupation of these states is, because if it were inside the contact, I'd have said it's F1. If it were inside this contact, I'd say it's F2. But in here, I don't know. So it's some occupation here, F, which I need to find. Okay? So whatever that is. So this would be then like the electron density in that energy range. Now, the rate at which it would want to go out into this contact or go out into that contact. In fact, let's write this one first. The rate at which it would want to go back out into contact one will be equal to this times gamma over h bar, because this is electron number of electrons times this per unit time. That tells you how many electrons per unit time get out there. And that is like the definition of gamma in a way, that this is like the lifetime. If I put an electron here, does it go out in a picosecond or not? So the rate at which it will want to go out is whatever electron density I have times this gamma 1 over h bar. And if I'm writing current, I should multiply it by the charge on an electron. So this would tell me the rate at which these electrons want to go back out into the contact. And I'll put a minus here to denote the fact that this is kind of going out. So in general, this is what I'd call electrons coming in is what I'd take as my positive direction. So I'll put a minus there. Okay, now if I want to write the actual current going across this interface, the thing is, this only tells you the rate at which these things go out. What I need to do is add to it the rate at which electrons want to come in. So I need to add another term there, which will tell me the rate at which it comes in. Yes, please.
I have a question about F. Why could I be
What I'll try to do is, so what we are trying to do is, right here, we're trying to write the current I1 at this interface. So it is as if we have this contact and we have a channel, and we don't even know about this part in this discussions at this time. So it's just trying to write the current at this interface. And what you'll see we'll do in a minute is actually figure out what F is, right? But at this time, it's almost as if we don't even know about that end, okay? So this is just for this interface. And so the rate at which it wants to go back out is proportional to F. Now the question is, what is the rate at which it wants to come in? Now, that's a harder thing to write, you see, because this one kind of follows easily. I got electrons here. If they go out at a picosecond, good. So multiplied by 10 to the 12th per second, you have the current straight. Now here you have this contact full of zillions of electrons. They all want to get into this narrow region there. It's kind of hard to tell exactly how to write that, you see. And the best way to write this is with a rather tricky argument, which goes like this. It goes that if this F were equal to F1, if those two things had been equal, what I mean by that is F1 is the Fermi function in this contact. And if this F were actually equal to that, then I know physically there should not be any current, because this and this would then be in equilibrium. They would have exactly the same Fermi function. That's like the level of water would be the same, and so there would be no net flow. So the current that flows from here in should be equal to exactly what I have here with F1 there. Okay. So what I'm trying to argue is that the second part is relatively straightforward to write down. It just tells you, okay, this is the electron density multiplied by the lifetime. That tells you how fast it gets out. That's easy. This one is not so easy. And there what I am arguing is that physically I know that if F were equal to F1, there shouldn't be any current. So this one should be such that it becomes zero when F is equal to F1. That's the only way it would be a consistent story. Okay? And hence, we write F1. That's the argument. So I guess the question came up before that, why don't we write F1 minus F2? Well, here what we are doing sort of is, we are saying that let's first write the current at this interface. And we have F1 here, and we have F here, F that we don't know. And so instead of writing F1 minus F2 for the whole thing, we're writing F1 minus F. Because if I wrote F1 minus F2 for the whole thing, I wouldn't quite know what to put for the gamma. Because I've got a gamma 1 here and a gamma 2 there. And last time I argued that I put them equal and I said, well, just put half a gamma. Because if it's 1 picosecond here and 1 picosecond there, it's 2 picoseconds overall. So here it's unequal, so I wouldn't quite know what to put. So we're starting from just doing F1 minus F. And with the same argument, you could write I2 would be equal to exactly the same story, but now it will be gamma 2 over h bar dA times. If you want to write the current here, I guess this tells you the net current coming in. If you want to write the current going out, you could write, I suppose, F minus F2. Now, you could write F minus F2 or F2 minus F, just depending on how you want to choose your reference direction. So if we think of my reference direction coming in this way, then this is F1 minus F. Here, if I take this as my reference direction, then it should be F minus F2. Okay? Now, I don't know F. I know F1 and F2. Those are the two contacts. So how can we figure out F? Any thoughts? Right. So the argument is that at steady state, whatever rate electrons are coming in, they must be going out. So this and this have to balance. Exactly. So what that means is that, you see, the part that's different between this and this is the gamma 1 here, F1 minus F there, the gamma 2 here, and the F minus F2 there. Everything else is common. So when I equate those two things, everything else will cancel out. And what I have is something that says gamma 1 times F1 minus F. We write that up here. Is equal to gamma 2 times F minus F2. That's it. So what that means is, if I bring all the f's over to one side, I'll get I've got a gamma 2 times f, and then I have a minus gamma 1 times f, which I can pull over to that side, and I can write them this way. And what should we have here on the right-hand side? Can you help me? Right. So you'll have this gamma 1 f1, and then this gamma 2 f2 pulled over. And hence, f is equal to so this is, of course, the thing that I was trying to get at, that when you have f1 here and f2 here, and then you have this channel in between, then the occupation of levels in this channel is given by a weighted average of what contact 1 wants and what contact 2 wants. And the weighting is determined by these gammas, as you might expect physically, because the gamma tells you just how closely coupled it is to that contact. So this is the argument. So you now kind of see where this equation came from. You see? Because what you have here, that's really F. That's really the occupation of levels inside your channel. And so density of states times the occupation, that tells you the electron density. And so when you integrate it, you get the number of electrons. That's basically it. That's what this equation. So I guess that's one result. Now, how do we get this equation for the current? I guess now that we have an expression for F, what we can do is take it and put it back into one of these. And of course, the F was obtained by equating these two. So if you have done our algebra right, when I put the F back in, if I put it in here or I put it in there, I should get the same answer. So we could do either one. So let's try this one. So what we're going to do then is, instead of this f here, I'm going to put in whatever I've found for f. This, you can combine the two and write gamma 1 plus gamma 2 in the denominator. Can you help me with the numerator? You see, multiply this with this, so you get a gamma 1 f1, but then that will cancel that one. And then I'll have a gamma 2 f1 minus gamma 2 f2. So what I'll get here is gamma 2 f1 minus f2. That's it. And now you can see, I think we'll end up with that expression basically. Because, you see, this part became gamma 2 f1 minus f2 over gamma 1 plus gamma 2. And then I have a gamma 1 here anyway. So overall then, this will become q over h bar. That gamma 1 I can combine with that. Times f1 minus f2. So this way you'll get the final answer. So that is basically that. So in a way, if you look at what we did, It's a little bit like, like saying that this gamma 1 over h bar here is kind of like a conductance, see? And these f's are like the voltage. So you could think of it as if you got these two conductances. One is gamma 1, one is gamma 2. And there is a driving term f1 here and a driving term f2 there. So these f's are like the voltage. This is kind of like conductance. And you're trying to find the current. And you're trying to find what is the voltage here, for example. So if you had kind of just thought of this as conductance and this as voltage, then whatever you have written would have written down for F is really this. See? This is exactly what you would have written down if this was a combination of two conductances in series. That's about it. And basically that's what we did. We said the current here at this interface is proportional to F1 minus F, just like Kirchhoff's law with two voltages, you see, multiplied by gamma 1. And then you say the current here is F minus F2, just again like Kirchhoff's law. There's the voltage across it, times gamma 2. And so, not surprisingly, the rest of the algebra is similar. So the effective conductance then is like what you get when you put two conductances in series. It's G1, G2 over G1 plus G2. That's about it. So the real important conceptual things to remember here is that it's the driving term is really this Fermi function. It's the difference of Fermi functions. And usually it arises from voltage differences, but it could also arise from temperature difference, as we have discussed. That gives rise to thermoelectric current, for example. So, but as long as the two Fs are different, that's what drives the current. And how much current you get, well, that depends on the density of states. Okay, now, overall, is the procedure clear how you'd use this set of equations? Or if you have any questions on that, please go ahead. Because I guess the next homework, which we'll post today, would involve a self-consistent calculation of this. That's basically it. Okay? Yes, please. Right. Yeah, very good point. So, what happened? I'd say usually in a given problem, you're given the density of states, let's say. So you're given some density of states in your conductor, and you are given the two chemical potentials. Usually you're given the equilibrium chemical potential, and then you say that when I apply a voltage, let's say one goes up by half V and the other goes down by half V. So you get mu 1 and mu 2. Equilibrium chemical potential plus QV minus QV over 2, of course. So I'd say when you're trying to evaluate this, F1's known, F2 is known, the density of states itself is known, the gammas are given. What you don't have, though, is the U, and that's where you have to do this thing self-consistently. You assume a particular U, and then accordingly, you have to move this D up and down. Now, in terms of a practical evaluation then, I'd say, yeah, that's basically what is unknown here, the U. Whereas what you did for homework one, there was no U involved. So it was a matter of just evaluating that integral. And the integral, of course, basically means that you set up an energy grid like this and then calculate the current through each energy range and add them all up. That's basically what it was. And at any energy, what is the current? Well, it's F1 minus F2 times the density of states in that energy. That was it. For homework one, that was it. For homework two, I guess, what would make it a little harder is that you have to iterate through. So iterate between this and this till you have a converged value for U. And once you have a converged value, then you can go to this equation and find the current. Okay? But at first, you have to iterate between these two. Keep doing this till your U that you guess and the U that you calculate after that are almost the same, almost meaning within a fraction of a millivolt. Now, one practical thing that's sometimes useful is the following, and that is, as you see, these integrals, they involve something like this. So you want to do this integral. Now this density of states is often a little inconvenient to move up and down. So what I mean is, supposing you have an energy grid here, like you have, and you have set up your density of states so it's like this. And the U, say, comes out as 2.5 millivolts. So what that means is, this density of states needs to move up by 2.5 millivolts. And that's sometimes a little inconvenient to move up by 2.5 millivolts, because that may not quite match your spacing between points that you have chosen, and then you don't quite know exactly what to do with it. See? That's the thing. Because you don't have an analytical expression for the density of states. So if the density of states had looked something like, say, alpha divided by E minus epsilon square plus some analytical function like this. Then if I had to move it up by U, I'll just, instead of E, I'll put a E minus U. And then if U happens to be some fraction, that doesn't matter. I could easily evaluate it. But if you don't have that, then it's sometimes a little inconvenient to be moving this one up and down as a practical matter. Now, on the other hand, these Fermi functions, you see, are analytical functions. You know, one of the things I said the very first day is, this is, you should remember, it comes up often, is that the Fermi function for a given chemical potential, electrochemical potential, looks like this. Okay, this is the standard Fermi function we discussed. So Fermi functions are easy to move up and down. Now the question is, can I rewrite this integral in such a way that instead of moving the density of states up and down, I'd be moving the Fermi functions up and down? Because it's a whole lot easier to be moving the Fermi functions. Okay? The question is, do you see how one might do that? Remembering that this integral technically runs from minus infinity to plus infinity in principle. Of course, you don't really have to integrate over infinite range, because typically you only, you know, density of states ends somewhere, and f1 minus f2 is non-zero only in this range. Okay. So any thoughts on this? The U? U, L. Yeah. Okay. That usually you'd be, yeah, this is based on this capacitive division idea, right? That roughly speaking, the picture we have in mind here is as if you have a capacitor here, a capacitor there, and a capacitor here. And so what is U? Right? That's the picture we have. If this is zero, what is it? So for a given problem, in these problems, I'll just tell you, assume U is related to the gate voltage and the drain voltage in this way. That's it. In practice, if you were to do it, you'd be solving a Laplace equation for it. But for our homework problems, I'll just say, assume that U is equal to, say, 0.9 times QVG plus 0.1 times, say, QVT. So what that would mean is, the gate has like 90% control over it, drain has, say, 10% control over it. So it ask you to use something like this, let's say. Okay? So that's how you get this one. So any thoughts on how we can change that integral? violate the charge neutrality. Right, but at steady state, what can always happen is, so let's take an example. At steady state, all it means is whatever comes in from here should be going out. That way you'll have a steady state situation. But that need not be equal to what it used to be at equilibrium. Because if you remember, this N0 is what it used to be before any flow started. So you could have a situation where the number of electrons in here is a little different from what it was at equilibrium. And this is especially true in small conductors. In big conductors, often it's hard to violate charge neutrality too much. Because it gives, you know, in a big thing, just a little bit, just 1% difference means lots of electrons and means a very big potential. But in small things, often it can deviate from equal. It doesn't have to be charge neutral necessarily. Although how close to neutral it will be depends on how big this is. Because if this is very big, then what it means is this has to be almost equal to that. Because otherwise, you'd have a huge shift in U. So a little bit depends on how big that is, on how close you would be to equilibrium. Okay. I guess while we are on this topic, let me just mention one other thing, and that is, I gave you an expression for N. But then to evaluate this, I need N minus N equilibrium. So how would we get N equilibrium? So equilibrium means F1 and F2 are both equal to some fixed value, in the sense that at equilibrium we had the same mu both places. That was the equilibrium Fermi function. So N equilibrium, if you want, you can use the same expression, except that instead of F1 and F2, you put in some equilibrium F. You know, you could call that F equilibrium. And both F1 and F2 are exactly the same thing. So then what does this fraction become? You'll notice if those two are equal, then you see gamma 1 plus gamma 2 just cancels out. So the whole thing just becomes F equilibrium. This whole thing then just becomes equal to F equilibrium, which is what you expect. You see, at equilibrium, when everything is in equilibrium, you have the same Fermi function every place. That's almost like, just as when things are in equilibrium, you have the same temperature everywhere, same chemical potential, same Fermi function everywhere. That's equilibrium. The reason our problem is a non-equilibrium problem is because we got two different mu's or two different temperatures. That's really what is driving the flow. Otherwise, there wouldn't be any flow. Okay? So the equilibrium N minus N equilibrium you can obtain by just putting those two equal to F equilibrium. So what that means is, if this is N, and I want N minus N equilibrium, then instead of F1, I could write F1 minus F equilibrium. Instead of F2, I could write F2 minus F equilibrium. But about the question I've been trying to get to, which is, how do you move this integral around? Okay, the idea is that you could call this E. So let's say I call that E prime. Okay. So then what happens is E prime is E minus U. So dE is really just dE prime. But this now then becomes E prime plus U. Yes, so basically that then moves the shifting to the Fermi function rather than the density of state. And that's a little easier to evaluate. For practical evaluation of this, that's often a little more convenient. Right? Okay. I guess we're out of time, so stop here today. Continue next.